The Indigenous Literacy Foundation is inviting people across Australia to celebrate the stories, culture and languages of First Nations people this Indigenous Literacy Day. The event will take place on September 2nd at the Sydney Opera House with a free film and live stream for audiences across the country. This year's theme is Country is Our Teacher, and following the film will take audiences on an exploration of sky country, exploring the connections between the stars, science, culture and storytelling. Speaking to SBS, award-winning children's performer and ILF ambassador Lucas Proudfoot says it's going to be a fantastic event.
You're going to see live performances, you're going to watch in that live stream a movie coming from the Central Desert region, and it's going to be hosted by Chris and Ninica, and it's all around that country out in Central Australia. And it's most importantly, this event's going to be a full celebration of stories and of language and culture, and showcases the work that ILF do, Indigenous Literacy Foundation do, and it's just going to be a lot of fun, action-packed.
First Nations legal groups have accused Prime Minister Anthony Albanese of failing to show leadership on mass incarceration of First Nations children. The National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services says the Prime Minister has refused to meet with them and are calling on the government to fulfil their moral obligations to keep Indigenous communities safe. The organisation says more than 200 organisations and 1,500 individuals have signed an open letter urging Mr Albanese to call an emergency summit on youth justice. NatSil's General Manager Nick Espy says the Commonwealth has the power to make changes.
The Commonwealth does have levers. We provided them with expert legal counsel advice that sets out their constitutional powers. They can set minimum standards when it comes to issues of child safety, and we're urging the Prime Minister to act on that and do so now. These are issues that are affecting all states and territories in the race to the bottom of progressive and punitive laws that see our children locked up, that don't see our children thriving and succeeding and getting the help and supports they need.
Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe says she is heartbroken by the announcement that independent member for Mulka in the Northern Territory is stepping down from politics. Yolngu man Yinya Mark Gayula has served the Eastern Arnhem Land electorate for 10 years and is an advocate for his people and Aboriginal communities across the territory. In a statement released on Wednesday, he cited several reasons for his immediate departure, including health concerns and suggestions of fatigue with the Northern Territory's CLP government. Speaking to NITV, Lydia Thorpe says she sympathises with the decision.
I understand his frustration and I understand why he's decided to resign. I feel like that most days in this place where there is no justice, there's no peace. So, yeah, I just think it's a real sad day for politics in this country, to be honest.
Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner Giriharan Sivaraman has told the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion that a database of racism should be developed to take the onus off community organisations. Mr Sivaraman says community organisations often collect this information but do not have the resources to capture the full extent of the problem. While calling for the National Racism Data Plan, he also warned that data sovereignty and anti-racism must be central and not used to surveil communities.
The only real way to get a full understanding of how racism is impacting communities like the Jewish community and other communities in Australia is through some sort of national survey or prevalence study, again, like we did in the university sector. And it requires courage because nobody's going to be happy when they see the results.
Over 50,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Albanese government to put human rights at the centre of Australian laws. Organised by Amnesty International and the Human Rights Law Centre, the petition urges the government to introduce an Australian Human Rights Act. Through evidence from multiple jurisdictions, it shows the Human Rights Act improves lives through enforceable protections such as preventing single mothers fleeing domestic violence from forced evictions. Human Rights Law Centre CEO Caitlin Rieger says the Act is the missing piece in Australia's legal framework.
Worsening inequalities are everywhere around us. And that means people are struggling to access basic needs like housing, education, and healthcare. Protecting our rights right now is more important than ever. Whether or not you can be treated with dignity and respect should not depend on your postcode, your income, or your connections. A Human Rights Act would provide that clear path.
A Senate committee will spend the next year hearing from women about their physical and mental health and postpartum care access. The committee is designed to elevate women's voices and experiences by holding public hearings across Australia. It will cover issues including fertility, postpartum health care, and women's pain. It will be chaired by South Australian Labor Senator Marielle Smith, who pushed for the inquiry following her difficult postpartum period, experiencing challenges with breastfeeding.
The agonising pain I went through and how this led to postnatal anxiety. I've also talked about what a difference good help can make in this period. I had the amazing support of a lactation consultant and with her was able to go on and feed my son for a year. But I'm very cognizant that not every woman is able to afford that kind of care. Not every woman lives in a capital city near that kind of care. And good quality postpartum care should not ever be left to a matter of luck.
Mass bird deaths have been reported across Tasmania and South Australia as authorities continue to seek approval for vaccinations for bird flu. Aerial surveillance detected more than 1,000 dead crested terns on remote islands off South Australia, while King Island off Tasmania, 28 dead penguins were discovered. Authorities in South Australia are seeking approval to vaccinate animals in captivity, including penguins and potentially other species. South Australia has the most bird flu detections of any state at 177. And now in sport, Sasa Oganowski is the new coach of MacArthur Bulls in the A-League's men's. He replaces Miles Dervojoski, who left his post by mutual agreement earlier this week. Oganowski earned 22 caps as a player before going into coaching. His last post was football director at Victorian club Preston Lions. The 47-year-old has signed a 2-year contract with the Bulls. MacArthur start their A-League campaign on the 17th of October at home to Perth Glory. And now for a look at today in the weather. Perth is mostly sunny at 9. Broome is sunny at 25. Darwin is sunny at 27. Alice Springs is partly cloudy at 15. Cairns is sunny at 24. Brisbane is sunny at 19. And Sydney is partly sunny at 18. Canberra is partly cloudy at 12. Melbourne is mostly sunny at 11. Hobart is cloudy at 12, and Adelaide is cloudy at 13. And that wraps up the latest in news, sport, and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio.
The University of Technology's Center for Indigenous People and Work, CIPW, is releasing its Truth to Practice Guide on Indigenous Inclusive Flexible Work. This is a new guidance to help employers create an Indigenous Inclusive Flexible Work culture, which extends the mainstream understanding of workplace flexibility. And joining us to discuss this guidance is CIPW Director, Professor Naren Young. Professor Young, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Your report highlights that mainstream flexible work is often limited to logging on from home. How does this standard corporate definition fail to meet the actual daily and cultural needs of Indigenous employees?
Well, I think the community perception of flexible work has gone too, and that's really come from the negative, from the naysayers about flexible work, has gone to flexible work being about working from home. And it's just not. It's been around for a long time. It can mean part-time work. It can mean condensed working weeks. It can mean purchased annual leave. it can mean time off for a range of caring responsibilities. Mainly it has been something that women have utilised. It's very clear from our research that Indigenous people want different forms of flexible work, and our work in producing our Truth to Practice guides gives employers guidelines from truth, from data, to practice to be able to put these guidelines into place in workplaces.
Yeah, you just mentioned that flexible work arrangements have been around, especially for women, and they are more than just working from home. We'll come back to how this affects women in particular, but the first consideration to look into is that 14% of Indigenous Australians hold caring responsibilities, and this often extends beyond the nuclear family.
We all know that caring responsibilities can go to extended family, the broader community. More people in our community have disabilities and chronic illness, and so more people in our communities are carers. It can include supporting parents, aunties, uncles, younger siblings, nieces and nephews, other community members. And the other really important thing is a lot of our nans are caring for children and young people. Our nans who are in the labour and employment markets might need the kind of flexibility that mainstream mums need, and our mums as well, but that might need to extend to nans.
And what practical steps can organisations take to meaningfully integrate obligations like sorry business and ceremonial responsibilities into workplace leave frameworks?
Well, employers can set the conditions for flexible work. They're not bound by anything to say these forms of limited flexible work are the only forms of flexible work that you can offer. Lots of industrial instruments, so awards and agreements, allow for different forms of flexible work, so cultural leave, for example. But employers can also say, well, we're going to listen to our Indigenous employees and ask them what kind of flexible work they need and provide it. It's not that hard.
Coming back to when it comes to how flexible work affects women, your research shows that Indigenous women often face higher scrutiny and mistrust, especially when requesting flexible arrangements. How can leaders address this managerial gatekeeping and ensure...
Those attitudes are just the manifestation of racism that exists in this place. And so what our research says is that Indigenous women are more scrutinised than mainstream women, particularly about working from home and their working habits and asking for flexible arrangements and leave and what they might need. And one particular finding went to younger Indigenous women trying to build careers, and they told us that taking flexible options is a career killer in terms of long-term career ambition. And of course, Indigenous younger women are no different to any other women now in terms of ambition and goals to build sustainable, very good careers. That's what they told us, that they're under more scrutiny than other women.
What training or structural changes are needed to equip managers to handle cultural flexibility requests with empathy rather than suspicion?
Well, we think that there's a lot of interest because we have a webinar being held tomorrow on Thursday, the 20th of August, and we've got nearly 400 registrations for that webinar. So that says to us that employers are interested. We've got all kinds of employers registered for that, from government to corporates to business to the NGO sector. So clearly there is interest. As we know, there's a massive degree of competition for our people in the employment and labour market. So we think they are clearly interested. We also have peak employer bodies coming to that event. So what we're providing is frameworks and guidelines. Employers are clearly interested in finding that out because they need to cater to Indigenous employees.
And this coincides with the release of new research that examines Indigenous women's experiences of flexible work and how flexibility is shaped by gender, the racial and colonial relations of power.
Yeah, absolutely. And that finding about younger women in the workforce and Indigenous women more generally being under more scrutiny than the mainstream is absolutely goes to those three relational things about being managed as an Indigenous person participating in the workforce. There is the element of racism that engenders mistrust. In the case of women, there's the elements of sexism as well. It's us bringing our intersectional identities to work and how they're responded to in the workplace, and that needs to change.
And how can employers ensure that work policies empower Indigenous people and women without forcing them to constantly justify their cultural needs?
We say that employers need to understand their Indigenous workforces in the first instance, that they need to uncover truths about what's happening for Indigenous people at work in their particular workplaces, because workplaces differ, industries differ, workplace cultures differ, industry cultures differ. And so we say, not just in relation to this particular issue, but in relation to employers understanding the makeup and the experiences of their Indigenous workforces, that they need to listen in the first instance and act on the truths that they uncover.
More and more organisations are actually implementing reconciliation action plans, yet there's still a gap. How can employers translate symbolic, you know, tokenistic RAP commitments into enforceable everyday workplace practices?
Well, we actually find that organisations that have RAPs in place actually do have better anti-racist outcomes, for example. There hasn't been a lot of discussion in the employment community about being responsive in terms of flexibility to cultural and demographic realities of Indigenous people. The trade union movement's done a lot of work around cultural leave and payment for the expending of cultural skills in some sectors, in the university sector, for example, but the adoption of these practices still isn't widespread. So we hope there'll be on our webinar tomorrow a lot of organisations that have RAPs. We work very closely with Reconciliation Australia in conveying our data outcomes to the organisations, to their RAP organisations. We will hope that organisations with RAPs in place will start thinking and talking about adopting these practices.
And finally, beyond just compliances, what are the commercial and organisational benefits for employers who get culturally inclusive flexibility right?
The reality is that First Nations diversity is the Australian diversity fundamental. So if you're going to be serious in your organisation about diversity practice, then as your fundamental, you need to have a commitment to your Indigenous workforce, to recruiting and retaining and promoting more Indigenous people, and that often takes the form of a good and effective rap. We think that obviously what's good for Indigenous people is good for everyone. So if you have Indigenous inclusive practices in place at your workplace, you're going to be more inclusive of all of the diversity groups that make up the Australian workforce, the contemporary Australian workforce. So it's sensible and practical to adopt these measures. We also know that employers want to retain and promote Indigenous people. So if they have Indigenous-friendly practices and cultures in place, that's going to be very helpful.
Before I let you go, anything I didn't ask or something you'd like to add to the conversation that would be really useful to our listeners?
The life circumstances and caring responsibilities of Indigenous people means, for some, flexible work arrangements may need to be a permanent aspect of employment, and work culture needs to get around that.
Professor Naren Young, thank you very much for joining us on NITV Radio and sharing the findings of your groundbreaking research.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm joined by Kate Constantine on the sidelines of her major exhibitions in Europe, in Switzerland and France, including the highly acclaimed Birang Ngara Belonging to Country exhibition at the Galerie d'Art Australie in Paris, described as one of the highlights of the 2026 summer exhibitions in Paris. Kate, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Kate, this exhibition was launched a few weeks ago. Tell us about the experience of having First Nations art, particularly your own work, exhibited in France and Switzerland, and being highly acclaimed by reviewers and experts.
I'm very lucky. I sometimes pinch myself and wonder how I got to this place. But yeah, you're right. Having my work showcased in Europe is always such a privilege and a pleasure, particularly in France. I think that there are so many interesting connections between the French and Australians. And I think that there is quite a really deep cultural understanding, even if it's not so much our culture, but it's culture in general, and therefore a very large interest in understanding the elements of our culture, our practice, and our storytelling. So I always find whenever I show in France, but particularly in Paris, that the conversations that I have with collectors and the public around my work are just very informed and very engaged and really very, very interesting. It was my first time showing in Switzerland, so I actually showed at Art Basel with my gallerist, Stefan Jacob, and it was really, really the juxtaposition between the Swiss and the French was quite pronounced. I think that the Swiss certainly don't have that background knowledge of Aboriginal Australia. It almost felt like in some ways at Basel I was starting at the very beginning, sort of starting the, you know, what is Aboriginal art? Why do we do it? What does it mean? Where the French are so much further along that education process in terms of what...
Yeah, I know the French have been actually engaging with the First Nations artists for many years now. I remember the Australian Embassy actually in Paris holds regular exhibitions. In Switzerland, it's a little bit lesser known, which is actually, I think, a very good opportunity for the Swiss to discover First Nations art. And what opportunities and responsibilities do you think come with sharing these stories in an international context?
So from a, I suppose, a personal perspective, like as a human and as an Aboriginal woman, from my perspective, sharing these stories is key to keeping them alive. So whether we share them here in Australia or whether we share them around the world, sharing those stories and keeping up the oral exchange, so the verbal exchange of those stories alongside the paintings, is really important. That's what keeps them in people's minds, in their hearts, and it also keeps my connection to culture and community strong. From a bigger picture, having people like the ambassadors, you know, for both France and Switzerland attend exhibitions and then talk to their networks about why, the movement of contemporary Indigenous painting is exciting, gives all of us more opportunities. So I see, you know, that I don't take that part of the job, if you like, any less seriously. I've always felt that, you know, if one person can do well, then it's their opportunity and it's their job to make sure that more artists get those opportunities to go overseas and to plant the seeds of their beautiful stories from their country with other markets.
And how do you think European audiences typically respond to First Nations art?
I've only really ever done two sort of art fairs, which are a very, I think, interesting little microcosm. They're like a little art economy of their own, if you like, because there's so many galleries with so many different types of art. So, you know, it's contemporary, it's heritage artists, it's, you know, everything from Picasso to a light bulb, you know, and everything in between. And I always just find that the conversations that I have in Europe are just much more intoxicating than I ever expect. Like, but you know, I end up almost hoarse at the end of the first or second day because people really are very engaged. They want to understand. They want to know not just about our culture, but about how this culture lives alongside Australian culture in, you know, large italics. Like, how do these two things work together? So I think that's really interesting for us. And I think that post the Voice referendum, which was obviously a really big kick in the guts for all of us, Australia hasn't felt like the same sort of safe place it has been. And I certainly think that because of that referendum, quite a lot more people know about Aboriginal Australia because of the no vote. It's seen very much almost like, you know, apartheid in South Africa many, many years ago. You know, I have quite a few people often say to me when I'm overseas, why did Australia vote no? It becomes quite a talking point. And whilst, you know, it's a talking point for all the wrong reasons, it does make people sit up and take a lot more notice of our culture and our value because they scratch their heads and can't understand why. So I think that that's been an interesting point in the last couple of years because that's only been in the last few years. But, you know, the engagement level is so high in Europe, and I think the understanding is so high amongst the French. There seems to be quite a solidarity between the French who have been colonised, also have been colonisers, but have been colonised, and, you know, our struggle, our, you know, plight to keep our Aboriginalness, like the French have kept their Frenchness, if you like, throughout, you know, lots of trials and tribulations in history.
And do you think art can help create, of course, you just touched on it a little bit, but do you think art will create stronger empathy across cultures and peoples?
Absolutely, because it's this, you know, the governments don't talk about soft politics for no reason. Soft politics is, you know, art and functions and gentle ways for countries to get closer to one another. And art is used as one of the number one ways for two countries who might not be as close as they should or want to be to get closer together. So art is the ultimate message stick. It's this, it bridges all languages, it bridges all creeds. It's something that can be used emotively to get people on the same page, to say we have the same values as you. You know, we understand where you're at in your current, you know, political climate. I think art more and more is being used politically. You only have to look at Trump renaming the Kennedy Center with his name. He's been really emphatic on, you know, disentangling art institutions like the Smithsonian. And, you know, really amazing museums that hold, you know, the true truth of history. History isn't always beautiful. It's not always pretty, and the story is challenging. But without the stories, without people who paint it or write it down or express it in a play or in a song or in music, we forget. And it's such a culturally intrinsic part of Aboriginal people's way of communicating is, you know, we're a gentle people. We're not a violent and aggressive people. So for us, oral history, talking, singing, dance, art, these are our ways to communicate with one another about what we're happy about, what we're unhappy about, what we want to celebrate. And I think that that really comes through. I think for an international market, I think that's what's really landing with people in a time that is really super politically uncertain, and we're all scratching our heads about, you know, a lot of different decisions that are happening in a lot of different countries at the moment. And I think that one consistent thing is that art can provide not just beauty and story, but it's connection, and it's, you know, this ultimate human connection in real life that is tactile and emotive and emotional. And I think we're all missing that at the moment. I think we're all missing a big bear cuddle and joy at the moment, and art can definitely be part of that beautiful matrix.
And considering your experience taking the art to Europeans and seeing how they engaged with your art and with yourself, have these international exhibitions influenced the direction of your future works?
No, not so much my work. My work is my work. I'm much more influenced by story and culture and keeping my connection really solid to my culture. So in some ways, I suppose I paint quite selfishly. But the market overseas for me has opened up a lot more opportunities that wouldn't have been available to me if I was just showing in Australia. So there's some really big projects that I'm working on with a couple of really big institutions in London and in France that are coming up in the next year and 2 years that would never have been afforded to me if I didn't have the runs on the board in the international market. I think it would have taken either a lot longer or would never have happened. It wouldn't have been championed out of Australia, which is a shame. But I suppose whichever way you get there to tell the story is, you know, is a win. So for me, I think it's more about opportunity, and it's opportunity for my children as well. Next year, you know, we get to live overseas for 3 months of the year while I do a big residency and open a show in London, and I get to take them with me and get them to show them an alternative way that our culture can make such a positive impact, as opposed to watching the news every night and finding, you know, so many negative column inches for my young children to, you know, feel quite disassociated with their own culture or ashamed of their own culture. You know, this is a beautiful celebratory way for them to engage in who they are and who their ancestors are and be able to talk with, you know, with pride.
Yeah. Now, while you're there, actually, if you're going to be staying a little bit longer, I recommend one weekend you just cross the channel, go to Belgium in Brussels. There's a small gallery, actually, private small gallery. I mean, it's small as it calls itself, but it's the biggest and longest running exhibition of Australian Indigenous art.
But I think the more that I travel, the more I find that there are pockets of people that have these just phenomenal collections that have created foundations and can be in far-flung places. Like, there's a beautiful collection that is available for people to see in Texas, of all places. And this wonderful woman who's been collecting for, you know, 2-3 decades. I opened a show while I was over in Switzerland, a third show, which my work was in, from a couple that have a foundation called Foundation Burkhardt Felder. They have arguably one of the biggest collections in the world, and they're in this tiny, beautiful little town called Motier in Switzerland on the Swiss-French border down south. And you hear about these amazing people who have just got such a long legacy of collecting, and collecting in a very mindful way. They're not, you know, going into art centres and, you know, trying to talk down prices, or they're actually aficionados. They know everything about the artist, where they came from, what they've done, what awards they've won, and they have multi-million dollar collections. And I think that to be revered by people of, you know, such stature is such a compliment to our creativity and our contemporary arts practice. I only wish that there were more of those sorts of people in Australia. I think that, you know, we've still got a long way to go to get people as excited here locally about the contemporary Aboriginal art movement, because overseas it's definitely landing.
Now, how do you hope First Nations visitors will see themselves reflected in your exhibitions in France and Switzerland?
I'd love for people to see a bit of home. I think that's the biggest thing, is a lot of us travel and are upwardly mobile, travelling around the world, whether it's for art practices or holidays or darts or different sort of family reasons. But I'd love for people to walk in and feel like they've come home. The work is very much centred around country and my belonging to it and it belonging to me. It's a very reciprocal, you know, connection between the works and my heart and my soul. You know, there are a lot of really, I hope people find them beautiful, really beautiful aerial pieces that are, you know, very abstract landscapes and really beautiful sort of geo-mapping in a really abstract painterly form. And I would hope that other black fellas walked in and went, yeah, wow, it's a little piece of home over here.
Yeah, and for overseas visitors, if there's one thing that could retain from the exhibitions, what would it be?
I think that there's a sense of real contemporary styling to my work, because I didn't grow up in the bush or in the desert. I certainly don't paint like somebody from what would be considered, you know, I don't know, a traditional centre. I grew up as a, you know, a concrete quarry, somebody who grew up in a town, in a city. So my work looks really different. It uses traditional mark making and traditional dotting and line work, but it's quite abstract and it's reflective of my lived experience. It's my authentic self. So I get a lot of compliments from people saying, wow, it just looks so different. And that's what I want it to look. I want it to be my own signature, my own voice and my own authenticity that people connect with on the canvas. It's like I'm telling a story. So I want people more than anything is, you know, to look at the work and feel it. If they can feel it, I've done my job right.
On that note, Kate Constantine, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. And congratulations on actually staging very successful, beautiful art exhibitions in key cities in Europe.
Thank you very much.